Hello and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast. A slightly different episode this time because we don't have any external guests. I'm joined by David Hamilton, the chief actuary here, and Mark Devereaux, our head of investment consulting, to have I was going to call it a little fireside chat, but we just had a heat wave, but a little chat about one of the big topics that's been buzzing around the industry for the last 12, 18 months or so. And it's the newest concept to pension called run-on. So this is the situation. Well, I tell you what, I'm not going to define it. I was going to go into a definition then, and I don't want to get it wrong. So David, can you just give us a definition of what run-on means when we're talking about that?
Okay, so yeah, in its simplest form, then run-on is simply continuing to operate the scheme as you are, continuing on. And that's, I guess, in terms of doing that rather than moving to an endgame solution, rather than rushing to buy out or perhaps to a consolidator. And I think for the purpose of this discussion, we'll park those schemes that are genuinely open to new members, still have a steady stream of people coming through, and will continue to operate as long as the employer is able to support it. Let's focus on those schemes that have a finite lifespan, a closed membership. And I don't think run-on means carrying on until the last member receives their final payment. Clearly, the costs involved in running a DB scheme mean that there's going to be a point where it's just economically unviable to do that, whether that's 30 members, 50 members. It will depend on scheme-specific circumstances to a large extent. But I think there is a contrast compared to perhaps where we were before, where you were trying to get to buy out as quickly as you could and would leap at the first opportunity. Or perhaps you'd be thinking, actually, once we're mostly pensioner membership, that's when the numbers will start to work for us. Or perhaps with the new funding regs in mind, you might think, oh, point of significant maturity, that's the kind of the point we're aiming for. I think the run-on discussion is more saying, actually, whilst we could afford to buy out, whether through scheme finances or the employer putting in a bit of a top up to get us there, it actually makes sense for us to continue to operate and carry on as a scheme for a while and defer that sort of end game point to a point down the line.
So we are talking about schemes that have a choice. I suppose that's an important point of what I was hearing from what you were saying just then. It's schemes that at this sort of juncture in their life cycle, okay, well, we could run on. We've got perhaps some sort of self-sufficiency or low dependency point, maybe better than that. So buyout is actually a realistic target. But why would schemes decide what makes run on attractive?
So there's a few different, some just won't want to go to the insurance market. Some, have a philosophical objection to doing so. Some will say the insurer pricing is too high, too cautious. They don't want to start putting in money to pay for insurer profits and have them, benefit from things down the lines. I think from a trustee point of view, there's increasing noise about actually should we be carrying on, because that way we can still exercise our discretions, perhaps apply discretionary increases to members, and therefore there's potential benefits for them for continuing to operate. I think there's also, greater investment freedom. You remain in charge of your own destiny. As soon as you hand it over to an insurer, you've no longer got any control of what's going on. Whereas if you continue to operate, you've got a bit more flexibility about how you run. And, the buyout cost should, we would expect, reduce over time. There's less uncertainty for insurers to allow for in terms of what members might do when they might retire, reinvestment risks associated with these sort of very long payment streams. So in theory, the buyout cost should come through over time. And that should mean that you're better funded and, in theory, you could be able to extract surplus if, again, we're picking out one of the other sort of current themes from today. So I think there are some reasons that mean it should have some attractions. Not wholly convinced it'll work for everyone, but there are some things to think about at least.
We'll get on to for whom it may or may not work in a bit, David, I think. But just for the interest of balance, so we've got this scheme that's just thought through the. I was intrigued by the philosophical objections to run on. I might push you on that a bit later on if you have time. But so you've got this scheme that has this run on mindset. But just in the interest of balance, what is the buyout mindset? Just to say, so we can, before we go back onto the run on challenges, why would buyout still be an attractive option for many, if not most, schemes?
I think certainty, you know, we talked about flexibility being, you know, the advantage of run-on. Well, certainty is the advantage of buyouts. For employers, the chance to exit scheme, you know, close this off. There's been so many nasty surprises for them over the years as the goalposts have moved. Things have become more expensive. They had, you know, investment challenges, regulatory challenges. I think for them to take all the risks out and be able to walk away and be done with this will have a lot of attractions in a lot of circumstances. You've got security for members. In most cases, we'd expect that going to an insurer will, you know, give you security. You're definitely guaranteeing members will be able to receive their benefits. I know that people will say, oh, you can't definitely guarantee anything, but I'll stick my neck out for the purpose of this podcast. So there's a security angle for the trustee. They've done their job. They've got members, the benefits they were promised under the scheme. You've removed risks. We'll probably talk more about the sort of the various risks of continuing to operate, but remove risks, removes an awful lot of costs as well for the employer, and just tied everything up in a nice, neat bow.
Okay. So that's very helpful. So Mark, I want to bring you in. Our listeners may have forgot you were there, but you've been there listening carefully to all of what David's been saying. And I think before we get onto the challenges as well, I know that there are a few, is we've got this with this sort of background now of, you know, we understand, our listener now understands what run-on is and understands the attraction of run-on, the attraction of buyout. From an investment consultant's perspective, how are you thinking about how the different strategies, if schemes are going to go towards run on or go towards buyout, how do they look? What are the differences and similarities between those different strategies?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So most schemes that have decided that buyout is the right route will typically be thinking about aligning the strategy. So it's what we might call buyout ready. So the assets are in a position largely to hedge what's going on in terms of the buyout price. What does that mean in practice? Well, it means that things like interest rate and inflation risks are hedged very close to 100%. It means that we're investing predominantly in very high quality, low risk assets, predominantly gilts and LDI and cash type assets, with the inclusion of some investment grade corporate bonds, perhaps. So it's low risk. It's not no risk. But it's getting the portfolio into a shape where it's mirroring what we expect to be happening in the buyout pricing, and it's in a state where it's highly liquid that we could sell if we need to and transfer to an insurer. So that's probably the starting point for most schemes. And that sort of portfolio works well for a low risk self-sufficiency type portfolio. I think when you're running on, that may or may not be the right strategy to think about, and it will depend on a number of different factors. Crucially, it will depend on funding position and covenant, as investment strategy decisions always should link back to those important considerations. But in a run-on context, the emphasis, the approach might shift. It might be less about managing mark-to-market risk relative to some funding measure, and that funding measure could be buyout. That could be perceived as the safety net. But it could be more about just the fundamental objective, about delivering the cash flows to meet the liability cash flows as and when they fall due. And that would mean a slight shift in thinking about cash flow matching, cash flow driven investing type techniques, CDI, which have cropped up in the past. And depending on the funding position, it could provide bandwidth to invest in more aggressive growth type assets. So it's really a combination of all of those factors, I think, Dave. Very scheme specific, very dependent on the attitude to risk. But crucially, as any investment strategy decision is, it's going to depend on what those big picture objectives are in terms of the time horizon for the scheme, what the return or risk objective is. And that might not be typical funding level type measures. It might be more fundamental measures. So all sorts of different things come into play, I think, in a run-on type scenario.
Yeah, no, when you were talking, I was just thinking about how, you know, schemes have probably been on a journey with their strategy, given the rhetoric around de-risking over the last 10 years or so, maybe more, from the regulator. And So schemes are probably on that journey, whether they know it or not, to are probably a more buyout aware strategy. But if a set of trustees are sitting there thinking, well, actually, you know, now we're kind of getting this understanding of what run-on means and that run-on is an option, it was sort of interesting to me whether trustees, how soon they should be actually having this as a conversation. You know, how soon out should you be saying, look, this is going to be our objective for the next, say, 10 years or whatever. Is 10 years buyout or is 10 years run-on? And you think, well, I don't want scheme to be sort of sleepwalking into an investment strategy that perhaps doesn't actually fit what they want, just because they haven't actually had that conversation, because buyout has been such a thing that no one's been talking about for years, really. Only in the last 18-24 months has buyout been a realistic conversation for schemes. So just in your thought about, you know, when should trustees be considering this, actually, their horizon?
I mean, that's an interesting one, Dave, because I think it links back to the time horizon, the current funding position. And if you're sat currently with a buyout deficit with no strong desire to close the gap through contributions from the employer, then buyout might be a sensible milestone target without sort of fixing down the ultimate end game today, if that's some way off, because invariably, if the gap's being closed with investment strategy, there'll be some risk that's required to generate the returns to close that gap, maybe in combination with contributions. So that might be a sensible point to aim for. And then some reevaluation, reassessment of the longer term objectives could come further down the line, because a lot can happen. As we know, attitudes can change and those objectives might shift as time goes on. So retaining flexibility is probably important for those schemes that do know where they want to go. Then it's eminently helpful, because we can formulate a set of objectives and effectively work backwards to the sort of portfolio of assets that we want to hold when we get there. So it maps out a nice, clear, logical path, which links directly back to those objectives. So it really depends, I think, on where the scheme is on that journey and how strong they are in terms of their views.
Yeah,
and I think there's a couple of elements within that. So, you know, the time horizon, I think, is important. You know, if you've got a sense that actually you are planning to be here for another 10, 15 years, it gives you a quite different investment picture to the thought that actually you need to, you know, you want to buy out in 3 years and you don't want to have the volatility or risk associated with things moving against you. And then part of that is, you know, your attitude to risk over time, whether you're happy to sit with the rest you've got right to the bitter end and then cash in, or whether you want to be locking down incremental gains as you go because you want to be getting more and more certainty as you move forward. And, you know, some of those themes tie in with the new funding regulations and whatever will come through the new funding code in terms of your kind of your ultimate path. But I think those are important conversations to be having anyway, so that you get the design of an investment and funding strategy that actually works for what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, Mark, I know you were thinking as well about the sort of the impact on what influence investment strategy has on funding. Is that, I don't know if you covered that already, but if you wanted to cover a bit more on that.
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. And again, this chimes with what we're expecting to see from the new funding code. And yes, and when schemes are in the fortunate position of being in a low risk, sat in a low risk investment strategy, you think about the types of assets that might mean pension schemes hold. They're largely high quality. So think about corporate bonds, they have predictable sets of cash flows, highly predictable expected return if we're buying and holding effectively those bonds to maturity. Then I think it does talk to the need to be much more consistent in terms of how the investment strategy interacts with funding strategy. And we might see a situation, and we already have seen situations with clients where actuaries are liaising with investment consultants in terms of setting discount rates which are more reflective of the asset portfolio. So discount rates, for example, that reflect the yields and the spreads on corporate bonds, where that's a large component of the investment strategy. And that leads into the thinking of things like dynamic discount rates. So it's setting a discount rate that has a variable element rather than a fixed element attached to it. So rather than, let's say, gilts plus half, for example, you know, if that that's often muted as a consistent with a low risk self-sufficient type investment strategy. It's just thinking a bit more dynamically about that plus half might be quite hard to achieve in periods where corporate bond yields are quite low, and equally when corporate bond yields and spreads above government bonds move higher, we see unintended consequences in terms of how that impacts the funding. But if we're still very confident that those assets will deliver what would be a higher forward-looking expected return, then why not allow some of that to come through in this dynamic discount rate type approach? So they're the sorts of conversations that we're already having and we're likely to have more of in terms of consideration of joining the two, the funding and the investment piece together.
Good. Okay, well, we've sort of talked through, you know, what run-on is, why you might choose it, what some of the challenges around the investments, but some of the things to think about. The reason I said challenges is because that's in my head. So I actually want to talk about some of the challenges of run-on. And I'm minded to sort of preface this with a bit of a, well, let's consider smaller schemes, because that's generally the market that we work in. We work with lots of smaller schemes, but I suspect some of the challenges that we'll touch on will be true of all schemes, because you know, some of this stuff has run through for all schemes. Actually, one thing when you were talking, Mark, well, one of the things is that was in my head the most when you were talking, because you were just talking about, you know, and you, David, to a point, but it's sort of that the covenant visibility with run-on, that's because, you know, we're used to integrated risk management. So, you know, we've got the funding person here and the investment person here. We don't have a covenant person, but that seems to run through everything. You know, the decision-making process, it might be all interesting what the trustees want to do, their philosophical point, again, David, going back to that, or their, you know, whatever their feelings towards buyout might be or run-on might be. Ultimately, the covenant visibility is key. I don't know, I'll come to you, David, just for your thoughts on how that works in the decision-making process.
Absolutely. I mean, it is key. And I think that probably is one of the areas that gives you a challenge. I think it's quite easy to construct an argument where actually, well, we're confident the covenants around it for ages, the employer is quite happy to support some investment risk, therefore let's leave a huge amount in equities, in productive finance, in whatever the growth, you know, assets you want, and let's run this for ages, and that generates a nice healthy return that we can pull off, and the buyout costs are coming down, and therefore there's a, you know, a really positive economic argument to do this run on. I think once you start saying, well, hang on, how much risk can we afford, and over the longer term can we guarantee the employer will be here to still be paying expenses, to still be underwriting a degree of investment risk in 10 years time, 15 years, 20 years time, it becomes much trickier. And once you're sort of in that funding codes, you know, low risk heading towards maturity, you're down in your low risk gilts assets, perhaps a bit of corporate bonds, but you're not generating that same level of investment return, immediately the numbers all come a lot more into focus, and it becomes a much more finely balanced argument. On the expense side, obviously expenses tend to be a higher proportion for small schemes than large schemes, just because of the large number of fixed costs associated with running a DB scheme. So expenses can be a challenge. And you know, if you're in a portfolio that's only generating gilts plus one, even, you know, the amount of extra return you're expecting to get, the amount of improvement you're expecting to get relative to buyout funding is reduced. We're talking probably about schemes that are starting to move past their peak point and start to reduce in size rather than grow in size. We're kind of used to seeing the numbers getting bigger and bigger, but as they're starting to run down and throw out more payments to members, then you do start to get a reducing asset pool, generating a reducing, you know, amount of excess return. And that all leads to a more finely balanced argument from the pure economic side, setting aside the sort of the other elements that we've touched on.
Mark, I don't know if you wanted to come in on any of those sort of challenges for run-on there.
Yeah, I think covenant visibility is a really important one, isn't it? When you're thinking about the time frame, when you're thinking about your risk appetite, and when you're thinking about, in practical terms, the sorts of investments that you might want to think about in the investment policy. And again, it might be a function of your current funding position, how much security and buffer is there to cover those things like expenses and other risks that you just can't hedge. So retaining a high degree of flexibility is likely to be attractive to cover events that might unfold that we don't know about, that might restrict how much we want to invest in those high risk assets. And it might influence how much of the portfolio we want to retain in very liquid assets, so that we do retain the flexibility to change course if something happens and we need to. So I think they're all really important things to consider in the round.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's all the sort of the economic investment side. There's, you know, some quite chunky other challenges that we probably need to touch on as well. You know, the regulatory risk, I think everyone's got long enough memories of being in this game to know that the goalposts have moved from time to time in terms of the regulations, the expectations, the management of risk, and just the costs of governance and operating a scheme. And, you know, we'll see more from the new funding code, and we've got the new general code coming in, all that sort of thing, dashboards on the way. So there's, you know, there's a lot of moving parts and no doubt more to come. So I think being exposed to continued regulatory risk and uncertainty has an element of gamble that you can't possibly hedge. A lot of schemes also won't be hedging their mortality risks. So if there was a sudden, you know, medical advancement that meant that, you know, not necessarily just to cure for cancer, but one that allowed us to all live longer, ultimately, if, you know, people are still alive, you still have to pay them their pensions. So, you know, that could move the goalposts and suddenly leave you exposed to lots of additional costs. And also, you know, you get into the idiosyncratic risks for small schemes. So that's just the point mathematically that, you know, experience doesn't average out. Mark mentioned earlier about trying to, you know, match your cash flows, but your cash flows will be based on, there's a, you know, 90% chance of the member still being alive in 5 years, or a 85% chance when to go down the line. And that might work for thousands of members, but when you've got 50 members, you know, a member can't be 80% alive. You either pay them in full or not at all. So the ability to actually match those cash flows is much harder. And then you've got constant tinkering, which has its own sort of additional costs and uncertainty associated with it. So there's a lot of kind of extra elements aside from the pure economics and investment part.
So can I ask you sort of the question that's most burning in my head? I'm probably going to put it to Mark first, but I expect David will have views on it as well. Is it realistic for a small scheme to run on? You know, so you've talked about some of the risks, expenses, all these sorts of things, but in your view, is it a viable option for, I mean, we're able to define a smaller scheme. I don't know, anything less than 50 million, 25 million? What's a smaller scheme? You'll have to tell me, but however you define a small scheme, is it a viable option?
Well, happy to take that one first, Dave. And I don't know how we define lots of these things in particular.
When in your head, when I say small schemes, what are you thinking?
Well, I think sub 50 million is probably
sub 50. Okay,
let's take that as our marker for a small scheme, of which there are lots and lots more thousands. now than there were a couple of years or so ago. Is it realistic? Yes, it's realistically possible. Of course, it is. Yes, depending on all the factors that we've discussed, can we assimilate the building blocks, the investment building blocks, to deliver a strategy which is compatible with run-on? Yes, we can. We have to be mindful of how we're thinking about expenses, as David said, especially for smaller schemes where they're proportionately higher perhaps than bigger schemes which have greater scale. So we need to think very carefully about investment return net of those fees and costs, building in suitable reserves where appropriate. But yes, we small schemes have access to granular building blocks where they can build pretty precise hedging strategies, cash flow matching type strategies. It may involve some compromise, but I think overall those compromises can be, in many cases, managed and overcome. So I think yes, for smaller schemes, it's an option where there's a will, there's certainly a way with the investment strategy to deliver it.
I think that's the critical point, that last comment, where there's a will. I think, you know, for so long, so many employers will have seen their DB scheme as a burden and a challenge. And to kind of flip that mindset for some of them that actually, no, we're not rushing to get rid of this. Maybe there's a reason you'd want to keep this long term. I think that's going to be quite a a hurdle to overcome, even, you know, pulling together all these numbers and trying to sort of see whether there's an argument. But I think there will be a reticence to make that leap and take some of those risks, given the history of everything that's come before.
I was going to ask you both perhaps a difficult question about trying to characterise a scheme that, if you were a listener now, you were thinking about some of the characteristics of your scheme, what schemes look good for run-on and what schemes perhaps look less attractive for run-on. But I don't know if that's so possible. Just hearing you guys speak just then, you know, it's almost, like you say, almost, again, that last point that Mark said, that David picked up, it's almost like if you want to do it, it's probably possible. But I suppose, what is the Achilles heel to it? Is it Covenant? Is it, I don't know.
Thank yeah, so I think there's a few things. Who's good for run-on? I think, you know, both the trustees and the employer are going to want it, which will probably rule an awful lot out. So, you know, the employer must have the appetite, that's presumably going to be driven by financials and the thought that they're going to get some, you know, ability to extract some surplus, some reduced costs, some economic benefit from doing so. From the trustees' point of view, probably the argument from, you know, members about getting discretionary increases, you know, is there a history of giving discretionary increases that you'd suddenly be taking away from people? I think those schemes will probably be more inclined to be looking at this. But the trustees will also want to be, you know, have they answer to why are we not securing benefits now? If they have got the financial ability to look at buyout, you know, why are we not tying this down and guaranteeing the members the benefits they're due under the scheme now? Why are we taking this gamble by continuing to operate? So I think that would be a challenge. I mean, I guess one thought that's out there is, you know, there is new end gain options coming to the market. And perhaps there will be employers out there who are thinking, actually, let's wait and see where the consolidator market goes to, what comes of the new sort of public sector consolidator. Are there going to be cheaper options down the line that mean we don't want to rush to buy out right now? But I think, you know, all parties will have to want it. And it would need to be big enough as a scheme and size of membership to mean that the costs work out as well.
Just to throw in one other idea here, Dave, the opportunity to make those investments work for some purpose or to make some impact. You have trustees and companies that are aligned on that front. Then you might see it actually as an opportunity to avoid handing over all these assets to an insurer or do what they'll do with them. But to make those assets work hard for some national or some local purpose or impact. So that could be a consideration, probably not in many cases, but some trustees and companies will be aligned in terms of that thinking.
Are you thinking about productive finance, Mark? You seem to be, is that what you're thinking? Because I was going to come to it, but I might come to it now, because we've done well not to say productive finance. Got, you know, half an hour into this nearly, and we've not said productive finance. But that, you know, we have to acknowledge, I think, that the sort of regulatory and policy backdrop to a lot of these things has been driven by the government's desire for schemes that have a surplus to use on, even on a buyout basis, to use that surplus for productive finance. And okay, I'll give you a couple of minutes, Mark, to tell us your thoughts on productive finance and how that fits into this.
We could spend a whole podcast talking about productive finance.
Well, I know.
How we define it. let's keep it simple. Let's say productive finance is investing with some UK or some local purpose. So to invest with impact, for all the reasons that we've heard from the Mansion House and subsequent speeches. So yes, if you're in a run-on scenario, of course that gives latitude to trustees and companies to think about how they might invest with some sort of productive finance type purpose, accepting all of those other things we've discussed about the funding position, the time horizon, covenant, and all those things. But you know, if there is bandwidth with given funding position and covenant visibility to lock away assets. And when we talk about productive finance, I think a lot of the time we're thinking about more liquid type assets, not strictly necessarily, but that's the thinking. So the time horizon obviously has to accommodate those types of less liquid investments. But certainly there are lots of managers out there that can help trustees and employers target quite specifically where they want to invest money and the sorts of purposes, whether they're social or climate related. You know, for example, renewable energy infrastructure that we need to get to net zero quickly. They're the sorts of things that pension schemes can quite legitimately be investing in to make that difference.
Yeah, I think that's a growing area, really, that sort of climate change. I think there's probably more passion perhaps from trustees and employers on that angle, kind of social responsibility rather than necessarily the Chancellor's kind of UK productive finance agenda that might be a reason for them to want to be investing in a certain manner.
And just finally, David, I just wanted to touch on sort of the schemes that may be listening or the trustees and employers might be listening that feel like, okay, run-ons as a choice is very interesting, but I'm in that boat for a list of reasons, I suspect. I'm in that position now. So how should they be managing their situation across all the areas we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you're quite right. There's going to be schemes, especially, you know, when you have to set down what your funding strategy is, who will be saying run on, not because that's the choice they're making over buyout, but because there's no other economic route for them to be going. You know, that has to be their mindset right now. Perhaps they've got a big deficit. All they're doing is trying to focus on dealing with their ongoing deficit. And there'll be some out there that perhaps their data is in a poor position. They've got really complicated benefits. They think they're just going to be unattractive to an insurer, not, you know, in a position where they want to be going to the market, and therefore they're going to be running on. But it's perhaps not not positive decision from them to run out versus buy out, but one they're kind of forced into. And that will have its own, you know, complications, because the question then is, you know, will there come a point where they are attractive, or where they just need to find a way to break down those barriers to get themselves to a position that they're actually more comfortable with. But for now, they may well just be sat there saying, well, there's nothing else we can do. But you still need to have those conversations about, you know, time horizons and things, just so that you're setting your investment strategy in a way that makes sense from, you know, risk management and all that sort of thing.
Okay, thanks, David. Well, I think we've run out of time talking about run-on. So thank you for listening to this episode of the broadcast. And thank you, David and Mark, for your insight into our thoughts on run-on. And we'll see you in the next episode of the broadcast.